Hi everybody, this is Catherine from the Media Education Lab, and you're listening to the Courageous Rhode Island Podcast, the show that finds common ground, builds media literacy skills, and encourages curiosity for the people of Rhode Island. Today, we're talking about polarization and stereotypes with our host, Renee Hobbs, and our guest, Katie Langford, who serves as Associate Director and Fellow of the Pell Center here in Rhode Island. In today's episode, we'll define effective polarization, and then we'll talk about how it's related to identity, how it contributes to anti-democratic behavior, what consequences may follow, and what possible solutions look like.
Hi, I'm Renee Hobbs, and welcome to the Courageous RI Podcast. Today, I'm talking with Katie Langford. She's the Associate Director and Fellow at the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University here in Newport, Rhode Island. So you're just down the street from me, Katie. So
yeah,
glad
neighbors.
You're here. Now,
thank
Katie,
you
have just completed a really fascinating report about the phenomenon that you call affective polarization. And, you know, with at Courageous RI, we're trying to build a community coalition to reduce the hate that leads to targeted violence. And the polarization that has happened in the political sphere is of significant concern to us. So what is affective polarization?
Sure. Affective polarization is the deep dislike and distrust of members of the opposing political party absent major ideological shifts. So we've seen a rise in affective polarization over the last 30 to 40 years. Since the mid-90s, the percent of Republicans and Democrats with a highly unfavorable view of those in the opposing party has tripled. So what all this means is that we've increasingly grown to dislike, stereotype, avoid socializing with those on the opposite end of the political spectrum without really changing how we view policy options, where we stand when it comes to policy decision makings. We haven't gotten more extreme in our beliefs, but our view of the other as a human has degraded.
We haven't gotten more extreme in our beliefs, but our view of the other has degraded. Holy moly, that is powerful. And you used the concept of stereotypes to help us kind of make concrete this practice of affective, or sometimes affective is like a fancy word for like emotional, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that description definitely captures it. What are those stereotypes, and what's wrong about them? Or where are the distortions, the key distortions in people's thinking?
Mm-hmm. I think if we look at affective polarization, we can see that there's a multiple things at play. Of course, it's a complex issue. One thing that I'll point to is that the parties have become more internally ideologically homogenous. So while we haven't gotten more extreme in our beliefs, Democrats tend to be liberal and Republicans are overwhelmingly conservative. So that means there's less difference within parties about the way we approach policy or even our thinking about where we stand. When that becomes the state of things, we begin to view that other party as socially distant and remote. Mm. Beyond that, our political identity is also becoming entwined with other really important social identities, including race and religion. So we see this coming together of religion, race, political identity. And political identity was already a really strong social identifier. So we're getting the simplification along party lines, say, I'm a Democrat, you're a Republican, that's our difference. That means that we're less likely to be in social situations with people of the other party, less likely to hang around with them, have friends from the other political party, or even want to date and marry those of the other parties. So we rely on stereotypes to understand that other, because we don't know much about them, and it oversimplifies things, and we tend to be wrong about our stereotypes. When you ask someone, what does a Democrat look like, think like, et cetera, they're probably going to say a non-white, young, urban dweller. For a Republican, they'll probably say white, evangelical Christian. Perhaps they live in a rural or remote area and they're wealthy. There was one cool survey that asked participants in 2018 to estimate how many Republicans make over $250,000 a year in salary. People guessed it was 38%. It's actually 2%. So one small example there of our stereotypes sort of leading us in the wrong direction, and that we're assuming all those in the other party fall under certain umbrellas.
Oh my gosh, that is fascinating. And I really appreciate your observation that as we stop being in conversation across across our political identities, then we don't have information. We have to rely on what we see in the media. We have to look at what we see in the New York Times, what we see on Fox News. We have to kind of, we are getting secondhand information about others, as opposed to the more complex and nuanced reality of the actual people in our community. Whoa.
Absolutely.
So in your report, you point out the ways in which this problem of affective polarization can contribute to anti-democratic behavior. Can you say more about that?
Sure. I'll start by saying there's a concerning lack to me of evidence that citizens directly support anti-democratic or illiberal behavior. And when I say those words, I mean things like restricting voting rights, banning books, denying election results. What we do know is that people, the citizens, are electing and re-electing politicians who purport such behavior. I don't think that means there's a causal link between electing officials and the electorate supporting such behaviors. It might be better explained by a lack of moderate candidates. People feel like they're voting for the lesser of two evils. They don't really like any of the candidates, but hey, they'll stick along party lines. Or perhaps even exhausted voters that make up sort of this murky middle between the two extremes that are inundated with partisan rhetoric. And they're sort of tired of the political game and sort of just check out. Last week, I was speaking with a scholar from Dartmouth named Sean Westwood, who's doing research into this area. And he said he's only found evidence that citizens support executive orders. So I'm not sure many people would say that's considered liberal, right, but it's the president overriding Congress, right, and it can indicate perhaps an imbalance of power. And if there's a Democratic president, maybe Democrats support that and Republicans don't, and it would flip if there was a Republican, right, president. If there is citizen support for anti-democratic behavior, it stems from the belief, or it likely stems from the belief, that the opposing party is an extreme threat to American democracy. And this is a really dangerous way of thinking, because it means people can support politicians or actions which deter the opposing party from going ahead with whatever they're planning, because that's actually the threat to American democracy. And we must stop it to uphold our American values. January 6th is a really good example of this, I think. Of course, January 6th was a horrible moment, but you can see people on either side defending or speaking against the actions of that day, even though, you know, there's a questioning of facts and it's much more complicated. But if we see the other as, well, if they win that election or they steal that election, that's a threat to our democracy, so we must stop it. You can see how dangerous it becomes and how it leads to violence. And of course, you could speak to that about how that got perpetuated through the media.
Right. Right. And it makes me think a little bit. There's so much to unpack in just that really interesting thing. I kind of want to go back to the idea that We support candidates who might be illiberal and anti-democratic, but we ourselves may not have those attitudes. I wonder about the way in which media and the sort of the attention economy that rewards the most outrageous, the most eye-catching, the most sensational politicians, they get a lot of airtime, right? They mm-hmm. get a lot of attention. And part of me thinks, okay, it is the ecosystem of the changing, increasingly digital media environment, is that contributing to the gap between the public and politicians in terms of polarization?
Mm-hmm. And I'm always really reluctant to continue this conversation of what can citizens do themselves? What responsibilities do the citizens hold to make progress against effective polarization without at least asking the questions of what role does the media play? What role do the politicians play? And why might those entities benefit from creating and expanding this chasm between the two major political parties in the U.S.?
Did you just say that perhaps the media may be profiting from effective polarization? Did I hear that right?
I think I'm insinuating that, yes.
That's fascinating to me. So I want to underline another really interesting observation, which is so important because sometimes media literacy educators get criticized by folks who say, oh, you're just suggesting that consumers, citizens, users, right, ordinary people can like change their own behavior to solve the problems of that are sort of baked into the institutions and the structures and the political economy that's way beyond that. And it's kind of oversimplifying the problem. And you point out there are things people can do, but there are things that institutional actors can do as well. And there are structural characteristics of the relationship between politicians and the press, for example, that may not be something that ordinary people can solve. Mm-hmm. That is fascinating to me. And so in some ways, that idea of what citizens can do, given all the things we can't do, we can't change the political economy of the media. Can we change the way politicians pay billions of dollars to media industries for mm-hmm. campaigns? Where are the low-hanging fruit opportunities as we try to figure out dialing down affective polarization has to be a really important job for the next election cycle, right? But how? Mm-hmm. How could it happen? What are some low-hanging fruit opportunities?
Sure. I would start at the individual level, given that efforts to reduce effective polarization are not in vain at the citizen community level. It can create a more empathetic individual that sees the other as a complex human being with a plethora of identities coalescing into one human being. The way to do things like to reduce effective polarization would be to first gain an understanding of what it is and how does it differ from ideological polarization. I think becoming aware of the lore of partisan motivated reasoning and that malleability of our ideological beliefs, which means that we tend to first identify with a party or maybe a politician that we like, and then follow the partisan cues of that party, and then shift our policy stances to align with what the party is telling us to do. So many people don't have firm policy stances. They sort of follow the leader in that sense. So becoming aware of sort of those brain hacks that are subconscious a lot of the time, I think can help us. Another way to reduce effective polarization is to correct stereotypes. So what are the stereotypes that we carry that aren't necessarily true or are not true across the board? And to point out to people that most of those on the other side do not hold extreme beliefs. Another assumption that we make about the opposing political party is that most of them hold extreme beliefs, which is not true. It's something like 30% of Americans, which, you know, is much lower than people would assume. The final thing that we can do is begin to highlight our common identity as Americans. What do we have as similarities because we all live in this country? What values do we commonly hold for American democracy, which most Americans agree on what the pillars of American democracy are? They tend to disagree about how the U.S. is performing in those, and those flip-flop depending on who's in power. So pointing out nuances like that while highlighting our commonalities can help. And again, that would impact your social interactions, community level interactions. Like you said, when we get to the national level or higher level institutional shifts, things become much more complex. And there needs to be more research in this area. One thing that I've been ruminating on is, how can we as citizens begin to pressure political elites or those in positions of power against illiberal behavior? Like, I think back on other times in U.S. history where there was high political tensions. You think civil rights era, post-World War II, Congress was dealing with a lot of major shifts. If a politician conducted illiberal behavior, they were shunned not only by the opposing party, but also members of their own party. There was a code of conduct that most of them followed. Now we're seeing politicians act against democratic norms, but still be accepted by their party because they want to keep the majority in the House, for example. So I think it's kind of an irony because I'm saying it's not all on the citizen to affect change, but we're powerful as a group to put pressure on politicians to ensure that they don't allow or accept illiberal behavior.
A beautiful way to think about the role of the public in communicating and reinforcing the norms for the way we do democracy in the U.S. And such an interesting phenomenon. I'm thinking, especially in light of what we're seeing with the George Santos situation, right? So
exactly.
How much lying will we tolerate from our politicians?
And most people would say they don't want their politicians to lie like that. So that would be a good example of, I think if you surveyed individual Americans, they would say, we don't want politicians to lie during an election cycle. But if you brought partisanship into it, it'd be interesting to see how many Republicans support him versus how many Democrats do. But that's a perfect example of, can we come together and say, we don't want this person to represent our Congress, and we expect the Republicans to also reject his ability to lead in Congress.
Right. And I'm really appreciative of the way you put this in a historical context. It's reminding me of back in the day when campaigns got so crushingly negative, where basically every ad you saw for a political candidate was bashing the other one. And that there was a point in different periods of time over the last 30 years where there was this anxiety about, like, too much negative campaigning is really corrosive to people's respect for the process, right? Mm-hmm. And so dialing back on negative campaigning, right, being really strategic and intentional and not making it be the first strategy you use, right, seemed to be something that politicians sort of were responsive to. And that happened after the infamous Willie Horton ad, right, where the outrage that developed after that ad in particular, the polarizing way that that ad damaged the way the public thought about politicians, did lead, for at least for a time, to some more moderate behavior.
Yeah, it's a good example of people, the citizens didn't like negative ads, right? They didn't work well. So can we do something like that where it's just not going to work for them if they try to do that? The other caveat I think that's important to mention here is like a lot of what we're talking about doesn't apply to those with extreme beliefs, whether they're politicians or citizens. I think that's a separate category. People with extremely extreme beliefs, right? Like I think politicians in the House that hold extreme beliefs, I don't know if that sort of pressure would work against them. It would work perhaps against the moderates who would help push them out. But they might just want to see chaos, right? And like you mentioned earlier, get their name in the news and get the attention from there and just show the U.S. like Congress isn't even really working, right? Right? Even though they're the ones putting the pegs in the wheel to stop it from working. So I think we're often talking about people in the middle, not those who hold.
Not the chaos actors.
Exactly.
Right. Right. Good point. Good point. I think, and that's right. That's a separate, I like the bracketing off of the chaos actors because you're right. Their motivations are different. Their intentions are different. And in a way, and that's a weird kind of I'm us versus theming, even as I do that. But I think it's, like you said, most politicians are not in that place. Most people are not in that place. That's fascinating. Hey, listen, right. So we've come to the end of our time together, but I know that the Pell Center at Salve Regina University has some cool things coming up this spring on this topic of political polarizations. For the listeners of this podcast, they're going to want to mark their calendar. What's cooking?
Sure. Well, first I'll mention that we've begun a new project called the Nationhood Lab that's led by Colin Woodard, a New York Times bestselling author, who's looking into this question that I mentioned earlier of what's our common national American identity? What's the story that we tell ourselves that resonates from coast to coast, north to south, of what it means to be American? So more coming out on that soon. And then on April 17th, which is a Monday from 9 a.m. to 12 noon, we're hosting a conference on U.S. polarization that's looking into the field of conflict resolution. So what best practices can we pull from the conflict resolution field to apply to U.S. polarization? And that will start with a panel with scholars from Dartmouth and Brown and end with a keynote address from Peter Coleman, who's a professor at Columbia University and author of a wonderful book called The Way Out. And that's open to the public. So we'd love to see everyone there.
Awesome. Look in the show notes for the link to register for that event. I'm Renee Hobbs, and I've spent 22 amazing minutes with Katie Langford. She's the associate director and fellow at the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University. You have opened up some really exciting ideas that make me more curious about what we can do as citizens to rebuild the bonds of trust and respect that we need to do democracy. Thank you so much for joining me today, Katie. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, Renee. It was a pleasure.